Jesus! Dickie Lankham whispered, clutching his brow with horror. What made you do it? He shook his head slowly, wonderingly. She was damned rude. Dickie dropped his hands and stared at him aghast. She was rude to you? Oh, my God, I don't think I can stand much more. Don't you realise that if she was rude to you, you should be grateful? Don't you know that there are thousands of peasants like us who go through their entire lives without being insulted by Miss Storm Courtney? I was not going to take that, Mark explained reasonably, but Dickie cut in. Look, old bean, I've taught you all I know, and you still know nothing. Not only do you take it, but if Miss Courtney expresses a desire to kick your fat, stupid ass, the correct reply is, certainly, ma'am, but first let me don fresh bags lest I soil your pretty foot. Mark laughed, the reckless mood still there, but fading, and Dickie's expression became more lugubrious. That's right, have yourself a good laugh. Do you know what happened? And before Mark could answer, he went on. A summons from on high, the ultimate, the chairman of the board himself. So the boss and I dash across town. Fear, trepidation, cautious optimism. Are we to be fired, promoted, congratulated on the month's sales figures? And there is the board, the full board, mind you, looking like a convention of undertakers who have just been informed of the discovery of Pasteur's vaccine. Dickie stopped. The memory was too painful, and he sighed heavily. You didn't really tell her to say please, did you? Mark nodded. You didn't really tell her she was not a lady. Not directly, Mark protested, but I did imply it. Dickie Lankham tried to wipe his face off with one hand, starting at the hairline and drawing the palm of his hand down slowly to his chin. I've got to fire you, you know that, don't you? Mark nodded again. Look, said Dickie, I tried, Mark, I really did. I showed them your sales figures, I told them you were young, impulsive, I made a speech. Thank you, Dickie. At the end of the speech, they almost fired me also. You shouldn't have stuck your neck out for me. Anyone else? You could have picked on anyone else, old chap. You could have punched the mayor, sent abusive letters to the king. But why, in the name of all holy things, did you have to pick on a Courtney? You know something, Dickie? And it was Dickie's turn silently to shake his head. I loved it. I loved every moment of it. Dickie groaned aloud as he took out his silver cigarette case and offered it to Mark. They lit their cigarettes and smoked in silence for a few moments. So, I'm fired then? Mark asked at last. That's what I've been trying to tell you for the last 10 minutes, Dickie agreed. Mark began to clear out the drawers in his desk, then stopped and asked impulsively, Did General Courtney make the demand for my head? I've no idea, old chap, but sure as hell it was made. Mark wanted to believe that it had not been the General. It was too mean a gesture from such a big man. He could imagine the General bursting into the showroom, brandishing a horsewhip. The man who could take such revenge for a small flash of spirit might be capable of other things, like killing an old man for his land. The thought sickened Mark, and he tried to thrust it aside. Well, then I suppose I'd better be getting along. I'm sorry, old bean. Dickie stood up and offered his hand, then looked embarrassed. You all right for the filthy lucre? I could let you have a tenner to tide you over. No, thanks, Dickie, but I'll be all right. Look, Dickie blurted out impulsively, give it a month or so, time for the dust to settle, and then if you haven't got yourself fixed, come and see me and I'll try and sneak you in again through the back door, even if we have to write you up on the pay sheet under an assumed name. Goodbye, Dick, and thanks for everything. I really mean that. I'm going to miss you, old chap. Keep your head down below the parapet in future, won't you? The pawn shop was in Soldier's Way, almost directly opposite the railway station. The front room was small and overcrowded with a vast array of valuables, semi-valuables, and rubbish left here by the needy over the years. There was a melancholy about the racks of yellowing wedding dresses, in the dusty glassed cases of old wedding rings, engraved watches, cigarette cases, and silver drinking flasks, all given in love or respect, each with its own sad story. £2, said the pawnbroker, after a single glance at the suit. It's only 3 months old, Mark said softly, and I paid 15. The man shrugged, and the steel-framed spectacles slid down his nose. £2, he repeated, and pushed the spectacles up with a thumb that looked grey and dusty as his stock. "All right, and what about this?" He opened the small blue case and showed the bronze disc nestled in a nest of silk, pinned by its gay little ribbon of white and red and blue. The military medal for gallantry displayed by non-commissioned officers and other ranks. "We get a lot of those, not much call for them," the man pursed thin lips. £12.10, he said. "How long do you keep them before you sell them?" Mark asked, suddenly reluctant to part with the scrap of metal and silk. "Oh, we keep them a year." The last 10 days of constant search for employment had depleted Mark's resources of cash and courage. "All right," he agreed. The pawnbroker wrote the ticket, while Mark wandered into the back reaches of the shop. He found a bundle of old military haversacks and selected one. Then there was a rack of rifles, most of them ancient Martinis and Mausers, veterans of the Boer War. But there was one among them that stood out. The woodwork was hardly marked, and the metal shone smooth and oily, no scratches or pitting of rust, and Mark picked the weapon off the rack, and the shape and feel of it brought memories crowding back. He thrust them aside. He would need a rifle where he was going, and it was sensible to have one he knew so well. Fate had put a P-14 there for him, and damn the memories, he decided. He slipped the bolt from the breech and held the barrel to the light from the doorway, peering into the mouth of the breech. The bore of the barrel was unmarked. The rifling described its clean, glistening spirals, again without fouling or pitting. Somebody had cared well for the weapon. "How much?" he asked the pawnbroker, and the man's eyes turned to lifeless pebbles behind his steel-rimmed spectacles. "That's a very good rifle," he said, "and I paid a lot of money for it. There's 100 rounds of ammunition goes with it also." Mark found he'd gone soft in the city. His feet ached within the first 5 miles, and the straps of rifle and haversack cut painfully into his shoulders. The first night he lay down beside the fire and slept as though he'd been clubbed. In the morning he groaned at the effort of sitting upright. The stiffness was in his legs and back and shoulders. The first mile he hobbled like an old man until his muscles began to ease, and he was going well by the time he reached the rim of the escarpment and started down into the coastal lowlands. He kept well away from Anders Land, crossing the river 5 miles upstream. His clothing and rifle and pack were balanced on his head as he waded through a shallow place between white sandbanks, and he dried naked in the sun, sprawled out like a lizard on a rock, before he dressed again and headed north. The third day he settled into the long, swinging hunter's stride, and the pack rode lightly on his back. The going was hard. The undulating folds of the ground forced him to climb and then descend, taxing every muscle, while the thick thorn scrub made him weave constantly to find a way through, wasting time and almost doubling the distance between point and point. Added to this, the grass was dried and seeding. The seeds were sharp as spears and worked easily through his woolen socks into his flesh. He had to stop every half hour or so to dig them out. But still he made 30 miles that day. In the gathering dusk, he crossed another of the countless ridges of higher ground. The distant blue loom of Charker's Gate almost blended with darkening clouds of evening. He camped there that night, sweeping a bed on the bare ground below an acacia thorn tree and eating bully beef and maize porridge by the light of the fire of acacia wood that burned with its characteristic bright white flame and smell of incense. General Sean Courtney stood at the heavy teak sideboard with its tiers of engraved glass mirrors and displays of silver plate. In one hand he held the ivory-handled carving fork and in the other the long Sheffield knife. He used the knife to illustrate the point he was making to the guest of honour at his table. "I read it through in a single day. Had to stay up until after midnight. Believe me, Jan, it's the best work yet. The amount of research is quite extraordinary." "I look forward to reading it," said the Prime Minister, nodding acknowledgement to the author of the work under discussion. "It's still in manuscript. I'm not entirely satisfied yet. There is still some tidying up to do." Sean turned back to the roast, and with a single practiced stroke of the blade for each, cut 5 thin slices of pink beef, rimmed with a rind of rich yellow fat. With the fork, he lifted the meat onto the Rosenthal porcelain plate, and immediately a Zulu servant in a flowing white kanza robe and red pillbox fez carried the plate to Sean's place at the head of the long table. Sean laid the carving knife aside, wiped his hands on a linen cloth, and then followed the servant to the table and took his seat. "We were wondering if you might write a short foreword for the book," Sean said, as he raised a cut crystal glass of glowing red wine to the Prime Minister. And Jan Christian Smuts inclined his head on narrow shoulders in an almost bird-like gesture. He was a small man, and the hands laid before him on the table were almost fragile. He had the mien of a philosopher, or a scholar, which was not dispelled by the neat pointed beard. Yet it was hard to believe that he was small. There was a vital force and awesome presence about him that belied the high, rather thin voice in which he replied, "Few things would give me as much pleasure. You do me honour." He seemed to bulk huge in his chair, such was the power of the character he commanded. "I am the one who is honoured," Colonel Garrick Courtney replied gravely from across the table, bowing slightly, and Sean watched his brother fondly. "Poor Gary," he thought, and then felt a guilty stab. Yet it seemed so natural to think of him in those terms. He was frail and old now, bowed and grey and dried out, so that he seemed smaller even than the little man opposite him. "Have you a title yet?" asked Jan Smuts. "I have thought to call it the Young Eagles. I hope you do not find that too melodramatic for a history of the Royal Flying Corps." "By no means," Smuts contradicted him. "I think it's excellent." Poor Gary, Sean thought again. Since Michael had been shot down, the book filled the terrible gap that his son's death had left him. But it had not prevented him from growing old. The book was a memorial to Michael, of course, an act of great love. "This book is dedicated to Captain Michael Courtney, DFC, one of the young eagles who will fly no more." Sean felt the resuscitation of his own grief, and he made a visible effort to suppress it. His wife saw the effort and caught his eye down the length of the table. How well she knew him after all these years. How perfectly she could read his emotions, she thought, as she smiled her sympathy for him and saw him respond, the wide shoulders squaring up and heavy bearded jaws firming as he smiled back at her. Deftly she changed the mood. "General Smuts has promised to walk around the gardens with me this afternoon, Gary, and advise me on planting out the proteas he brought me from Table Mountain. You are also such a knowledgeable botanist. Will you join us?" "As I warned you, my dear Ruth," said Jan Smuts in that ready yet compelling voice, "I do not give much hope for their survival." "Perhaps the leucodendrons," ventured Gary, "if we find a cool, dryish place?" "Yes," agreed the general, and immediately they fell into an animated discussion. She had done it so skillfully that she seemed to have done nothing. Sean paused in the doorway of his study and ran a long, lingering gaze over the room. As always, he felt a glow of pleasure at re-entering this sanctuary. The glass doors opened now onto the massed banks of flowers and the smoking plumes of the fountain, yet the thick walls ensured that the room remained cool even in the sleepy hush of midday. He crossed to the desk of Stinkwood, dark and massive and polished, so that it shone even in the cool gloom, and he lowered himself into the swivel chair, feeling the fine leather stretch and give under his weight. The day's mail was neatly arranged on a silver salver at his right hand, and he sighed when he saw that despite the careful screening by the senior clerk down at the city head office, there was still not much less than 100 envelopes waiting him. He delayed the moment by swinging the chair slowly to look once again about the room. It was hard to believe it had been designed and decorated by a woman, unless it was a woman who loved and understood her man so well that she could anticipate his lightest whim and fancy. Most of the books were bound in dark green leather and stamped on their spine in gold leaf with Sean's crest. The exceptions were the three ceiling-high shelves of first editions with African themes. A dealer in London and another in Amsterdam had carte blanche instructions from Sean to search for these treasures. There were autographed first editions by Stanley, Livingston, Cornwallis, Harris, Burchell, Munro, and almost every other African explorer or hunter who had ever published. The dark panelled woodwork between the bookshelves was studded with the paintings of the early African artists. The banes glowed like rich gems in their flamboyant colours and naive, almost childlike depiction of animal and countryside. One of these was set in an intricately carved frame of Rhodesian redwood and engraved, "To my friend David Livingstone, from Thomas Baines." These links with history and the past always warmed Sean with pleasure, and he fell into a mild reverie. The deep carpeting deadened her footsteps, but there was the light perfume on the air that warned Sean of her presence, and he swung his chair back to the desk. She stood beside his chair, slim and straight as a girl still.